Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. In the early 1990s, the U.S. crime rate had been on a steep upward climb since the Johnson presidency of the 1960s. The crack cocaine epidemic of the mid-1980s made things even worse. Handgun-related homicides more than doubled between 1985 and 1990. That year, murders peaked in New York City with 2,245 killings. In San Antonio at that time, we were seeing nightly multiple drive-by shootings. Politicians embraced tough-on-crime platforms, and it was baked into the judicial system, racially targeted super enforcement and mandatory minimums that created a society of mass incarceration. Elizabeth Hinton writes about it in her new book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. Dr. Hinton is also an assistant professor of history and African-American studies at Harvard University. And Professor Hinton, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Why is it important to make this connection between mass incarceration and the Johnson administration?
Well, we often think of, you know, the emergence of the war on drugs and kind of tough on crime policies emerging with the Reagan administration. But what history shows us is that Reagan stepped into a much larger, longer historical process that began at the height of the liberal welfare state and the civil rights revolution during the Johnson administration. And we have to understand that Johnson's kind of urban intervention that took the form of the war on poverty and promoted social welfare programs in urban and rural areas was also accompanied by his declaration of the war on crime and a whole new level of investment at the federal level in state and local law enforcement for the first time in U.S. history. And so he calls for the war on crime in 65. The federal government incentivizes a new priority on crime control and law enforcement, really focusing on, during the Johnson era, militarizing urban police forces, and subsequent administrations continue to kind of take this precedent that Johnson set and expand it. And so we really need to understand mass incarceration is not suddenly appearing out of nowhere in the late 80s and 90s, but really the outgrowth of this kind of larger, longer punitive priority that emerged at the national level that first emerged during the Johnson administration.
So we have this way of thinking about how to deal with poverty and crime, and then there's problems, I think, with the way that we do that across the United States. And so did we create policies that would target particularly low-income folks in communities, African-Americans and Latino areas? So that was it something that Johnson did in order to try and get his programs, his Great Society programs, passed? He was also to say, but we're also going to beat up on the criminals.
Exactly. So during the Johnson administration, and we can, and this, you know, the seeds of this emerge in the Kennedy administration, actually, but Johnson's punitive programs and his social welfare programs were really part of this kind of larger Great Society initiative that was really intended to improve American society. The idea was that warring on poverty is warring on crime, that in order to kind of get at the larger root causes of crime and violence in American cities, that there also needed to be a social welfare intervention. The problem is that increasingly, as rates of reported crime were higher during the second half of the 1960s, as incidents of riots or urban civil disorder continue to escalate, policymakers across the political spectrum start moving kind of further and further away from the social welfare impulses in domestic policy and increasingly embrace and allocate funding for crime control programs. And by the time we get to really the Ford administration, the national government had significantly disinvested from many Great Society programs while privileging kind of punitive responses to urban poverty and inequality. So the Johnson administration sought to use the war on poverty and the war on crime as a way to solve the problems of poverty. And by the time we get to, and this is a transition that happens in the Nixon administration, but by the time we get to Ford, crime control becomes a means to manage the symptoms of poverty, of failing public school systems, of mass unemployment, et cetera.
So I want to look at your reporting in your book, and you do some great stuff going to original documents, that some stuff that hasn't even been seen before. And it's amazing to me how it really wasn't that long ago, but how people can, how the memories have changed about how we got to where we are today, and you kind of correct the record. But it's really about creating policy that works today. Is that your interest?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I'm a historian, and I think if we really want to understand how we got into the place that we are today, especially if we want to understand mass incarceration as you know, not emerging out of nowhere, but again, the result of sets of decisions that were made, in my view, at the highest level of government, and policy choices that were embraced at all levels of government, we have to understand how, you know, the maybe wrong policy turns that have been taken for the past 50 years, if we want to think about undoing some of the damage of the rise of and the marked expansion of American law enforcement and prison systems in the last decades of the 20th century and into the 21st.
And to that point, we hear this all the time that this war on crime and this mass incarceration policies were things that the black community was asking for, this, that the leaders of the black community called for it, that the black caucus in Congress voted for these things. But as you report in your book, that this is just a selective hearing of what the black community was calling for.
Yeah, and part of that, too, is we have to be, this is why history is important. You know, even the shift in response of African-American residents who, you know, experienced the kind of rise of the war on crime, the influx of urban police forces firsthand, the responses to these programs change. So in the late 60s, we could say that, you know, the Black Panthers and the rise of other radical African-American activist groups calling for armed self-defense and tenant patrols and things like that were the kind of initial response to this kind of massive expansion of urban police forces. In the 70s and 80s, that begins to change. Part of the point that we wanted to make in our op-ed in the New York Times that kind of uses this concept of selective hearing is that, yes, African Americans are calling for better policing. What politicians tend to hear is more policing. These calls for better policing, these calls for crime prevention, et cetera, were also accompanied with demands for more, better education programs, a voice over police departments, so civilian review boards, a say in how crime control programs would be implemented in communities, early childhood education programs, employment programs, et cetera. So these visions, these ideas of how to make communities safer coming from the black community looked very different than what lawmakers actually implemented. So instead of, you know, really, really kind of taking a larger, more comprehensive, preventative approach to crime control, consistently and historically, policymakers respond with more police, with harsher sentences, et cetera.
So they say we need better policing in our communities. We do want to have safe communities, but that doesn't mean we want more super policing, tougher policing, almost militaristic type of policing happening to our neighborhoods where you shoot first and ask questions later.
Right, exactly. And by the time we get to, you know, the 1980s, at the height of the crack epidemic, when essentially, you know, the last public program standing in many low-income communities in the United States are police officers, are law enforcement. You know, when you need right. help, when your son is on crack and robbing you, you have no choice but to call the police and right. to treat this as a criminal issue rather than, you know, going to a
right.
drug rehabilitation center.
Okay, I'm going to take a quick break. Quick break right here. We'll be right back. This is The Source. You're listening to The Source on KSTX on 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty also included a punitive punch, a war on crime that began the trend towards mass incarceration of poor Latinos and African Americans, even more so in the 1990s, with billions of dollars for prisons and police, but little for preventative efforts and jobs. What went wrong? We're talking about the book from the war on poverty to the war on crime, the making of mass incarceration in America. The author is Dr. Elizabeth Hinton. She is a professor, assistant professor of history and African-American studies at Harvard University. What do you remember about the war on crime and mass incarceration, how we got here? How do you think things are working out now? We're seeing a huge turnaround. We're safe. You know, we're seeing a lot of crime is being reduced, Dr. Hinton. And how do we get here?
The lessening of crime?
Yeah.
Rates reported crime going down? Well, I mean, it doesn't have anything. There's been no social science research that has successfully established a strong correlation between incarceration and crime rates. If you look at, you know, graphs that chart incarceration and crime, they're kind of all over the place. So there's no direct correlation between, you know, the idea that incarceration somehow has led to the decline in crime or that mass incarceration has served as a crime and deterrent is actually just false. You know, I think that crime is a really difficult thing to measure. I think part of it has to do with technology and you know, kind of social situations changing, but there's no you know, clear sense of why crime has gone down. Some people say that it has to do with demographics and birth rates. You know, I have no concrete explanation for why crime declined in the 1990s.
Well, some conservatives do claim, hey, look at the facts, look at the graphs. But we don't know the causational reasons why crime went down. That doesn't mean they can't that they can spin their stories any way they want. But in the 1994, we did have the crime bill. And there was a plan to have some programs in there. I remember midnight basketball and other issues that were supposed to be there to help reduce crime. But that got slashed.
Yes. So that was so in the debates in the bill, you know, a lot of the prevention programs, which initially were more than double what they ended up being, I think the Congressional Black Caucus in their earlier version of the 94 crime bill proposed a total of $5 billion for prevention programs, and the final bill had about less than half of that. In part, it's because Republican senators like Bob Dole, you know, saw these prevention programs as pork, and as they called them, or welfare for criminals, and refused to pass the legislation with that kind of level of prevention funding. And President Clinton ultimately conceded to their demands, and so did many of the members of the CBC, who feared that unless this version of the bill passed, another far more draconian version of the bill would replace it. So they voted for the bill because there was some prevention funding still intact, and they wanted to get what little prevention funding they could to their communities. But again, even programs like Midnight Basketball don't necessarily help us, you know, solve the larger kind of socioeconomic problems, I think, that really lead to crime, harm in low-income communities, violence, inequality,
right,
but kind of social problems of our time.
But Midnight Basketball, that was the poster child that the conservatives were using to slash the funding for the preventative aspects of the crime bill.
Right.
And so
one of the many.
We had one of them, but that was like the one I kept hearing about all the time. So we heard the term super predator. What is that?
So it's this idea that they're coined by Don DeLillo, the idea that they're a group of youth who are conscienceless, who are violent by nature, and who, even though they, you know, they're this group is racialized and spatialized, and that there is, and that super predator usually refers to a black, less so Latino youth in the early 1990s. That this group is a threat to society, and even though they're kind of they're confined in urban spaces, they live in urban spaces, they could at any moment kind of come and terrorize a family far, far away. And so it really, so this image, this idea of the super predator really kind of evokes there.
Okay, we're kind of losing the signal. Let's see if it cleans up a little bit. And Dr. Hinton, can you hear me there? All right, so the signal got really dirty really quick. We're going to try and clean that up in just a second. We're talking about the book From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. And, you know, the United States is currently home to the largest prison system in the world. Although the U.S. represents 5% of the world's population, it holds 25% of its prisoners, with one in every 31 adults under some form of penal control. Today, roughly 2.2 million U.S. citizens are behind bars, signifying a 943% increase over the last 50 years. And Dr. Hinton, are you back with us? And it looks like the signal is down. Our phone lines are open. We've been hearing about how the LBJ and the history behind his war on poverty is lockstep with the history of mass incarceration. Is that how you remember it? Listeners, give us a call. What do you think about the war on crime leading to mass incarceration and how it brought us to where we are today with the hashtag Black Lives Matter? And give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And we got a caller on the line. Tamer is with us. Tamer, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about the financial incentives and aspect for the what I would call the prisoner or prison industrial complex with these private prisons, private prison companies that run prisons and immigration facilities, as well as the folks that provide ancillary services like tracking and DWI type of technology. Aren't these companies and these folks just making billions and billions of dollars off of a system that's being fed by the government?
Yes, that's true. Tamer, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. We know that in the 1994 anti-crime bill that was signed by the Clinton administration and what was co-authored by Joe Biden, that it was set aside $7.4 billion for prison expansion and for funding for policing across the United States. A lot of that money did go to private corporations. And as you talk about, even today, we have, you know, we talk about ankle monitors that are given to, not given to, but issued to people who are on probation or out on jail for on bail. They have to pay quite a bit every month to have that that ankle monitor on them, and that is a burden, an additional burden for anyone who is caught in the judicial system. Another caller with Jesse. Hi, Jesse. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air as we talk about the war on poverty to the war on crime.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. You know, one of my, I'm going to try and get right to the point here, and then you can take it wherever you want. The amount of prisoners that we have, as you mentioned, we have over 2 million people in prison right now. You know, if we, and the biggest problem with that is the amount of money we have to take into account for all that. If we would try to educate these people that,
okay,
and you know, we could probably cut down on crime inside and outside the prisons by them having some desire to do something else with their life when they get out.
All right, Jesse, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. And now we've returned with Dr. Hinton, and maybe she can respond to that using taking some of the money away from incarceration and putting towards treatment and rehabilitation.
Yes, I heard the end of the comment, and I'm completely with that. I think that if we, as we begin to think about a possible road out of mass incarceration and begin to decarcerate people, it's got to come with comprehensive educational and job creation programs. I think that, you know, this is the country of second chances, and I think that people deserve second chances, especially after they serve their time. And while they're serving their sentence, they should be able to receive and get an education so that they can do something productive with their lives, and then afterwards, you know, have a road to a job so that they don't end up back in prison. Without comprehensive rehabilitation, the likelihood that somebody who was recently released from prison will return shortly afterwards is incredibly high, and it's our responsibility, I think, in terms of our policies to address that.
Another caller, Stephen. Stephen, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I heard a program about on Freakonomics, I think Stephen Dubner, and it had a very compelling argument that one reason why crime is so low is because of the legalization of abortion. happened at a point when that particular cohort of people who were prime crime age just were not born and were not there to commit the crimes. I wonder if you have a comment for that.
All right, Stephen, thank you for the call. And Dr. Hilton?
It's an interesting theory. There are all kinds of different theories about why crime has gone down. And even, you know, as policymakers were studying and social scientists were studying the crime rate, really once we get a major crime control apparatus, statistical apparatus after Johnson's call for the war on crime, really it's difficult to come up with a concrete explanation for why crime rises or falls, for that matter. And in many respects, policymakers themselves choose not to comment on the causes of what makes crime rise and fall precisely for that reason.
Right, and another dominant theory is the removal of lead from the environment, and that has reduced crime, but that brings it to mind what's happening in Flint, Michigan. And Dr.
Right.
Hinton, thank you so much for joining us. The book is From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America, and this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.